forget for now. Anyway, what is Janet Yellen thinking? Here is the new question. Can he do that? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Monday, the 5th of December. Good as always to have you with us, everybody. We begin today with a not unfamiliar topic, global trade and the American role in it in a Trump administration. During the campaign, the president-elect made no small number of promises about what he is going to do once he's in office. He's doubled down on some of them since the election. For example, just this weekend, tweeting that companies that move production out of the United States would face a 35% tariff, a tax that is, on goods they want to sell here. Quote, please be forewarned prior to making a very expensive mistake, he tweeted. To which we say, can he do that? Marketplace's Sabri Benishor starts us off.
First up, the president-elect threatened to renegotiate NAFTA. Can he do that without Congress?
The president has the authority to withdraw, and the president could certainly seek to renegotiate the terms.
Miriam Shapiro is a partner at Finsbury and a former deputy U.S. trade representative. The president-elect has also said he might slap tariffs on Mexico and China. Can he snap his fingers to do that? Depends on the tariff, but in some cases, yes, there are ways.
But it is highly questionable whether such a practice would be sustained by U.S. courts or by the WTO.
Richard Weiner is a partner at international trade law firm Sidley Austin. And then there is the question of whether Trump can single out U.S. companies that move production elsewhere.
There is no provision in U.S. law that allows the Department of Commerce to selectively apply duties in this manner.
There may be an exception. Rachel Brewster teaches trade law at Duke. She says the government could go after dumping. That's where companies sell goods super cheap to hurt competitors. She says a president could accuse companies of doing this, even if they're not, and levy a 35% tax. The threat alone could force some companies to comply.
You can very easily use the tools that the president has to coerce certain high-profile corporations into making concessions.
Not all corporations, but a few examples here or there. So a president does have broad leeway when it comes to trade. But the level of retaliation he and U.S. exporters might face from other nations, that's a whole other story. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishor for Marketplace.
The Dakota Access Pipeline has been stopped for now, I'm obliged to add, because President-elect Trump has promised more oil, gas, and coal production in this country. But fossil fuel opponents saw the pipeline project as part of a more long-term strategy, as Marketplace's Annie Baxter tells us.
People worried about climate change will sometimes talk about carbon lock-in. The idea is that the fossil fuel-based energy investments we make today will commit us to them and their greenhouse gas emissions for a long time.
If we build a new coal plant, that coal plant will be around for 50 years. If we build a gas or oil pipeline, that piece of fossil fuel infrastructure will also be around for decades.
That's Michael Brune, executive director of the Sierra Club, the environmental advocacy group. It's one of several groups trying to thwart fossil fuel infrastructure projects through protests and litigation. And oil and gas pipelines are a natural target. That's according to Michael Weber at the Energy Institute at the University of Texas at Austin.
If you can't move your fossil fuel product to market, that's kind of the same as stopping its use at the end or stopping its production at the front side.
And that, Weber says, will drive up the cost of those fossil fuels, potentially giving renewables like wind and solar an opening to grab more market share. But he says the opposite could also happen. Even though renewables are competing more effectively than ever with fossil fuels like natural gas, making the latter more expensive could backfire. Matthew Hoza is an energy analyst at BTU Analytics.
So really what we would see if natural gas were to become more expensive because pipelines are delayed or canceled, what you would actually see is more coal generation coming back into play.
Coal, which throws off even more harmful carbon emissions than natural gas. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, not so bad for a Monday. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Italian Prime Minister Matteo Renzi went to resign today in the wake of losing that big referendum on government control of the economy yesterday. And the president of Italy said to him, hey, could you wait till we get a budget bill passed? That's actually a true story. Renzi's going to wait. About 60% of Italians voted against the prime minister, and now the third largest economy on the continent is in for a period of major political and financial uncertainty. Marketplace's Stephen Beard is just back from Rome. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Kai.
Walk me through. Why is a vote on the Italian constitution such a big deal?
Renzi made it a big deal with his, back me or sack me threat by saying, you push through these constitutional measures or I resign. He turned it into a conduit for the huge amount of discontent that's built up in Italy since the financial crisis. Discontent over 11% unemployment, 37% unemployment for young people. Many Italians blame their low growth, their high unemployment economy on being a part of the euro and having to accept, for example, austerity at the behest of the Germans. Daniel Caprera, the spokesman for the opposition Five Star Movement, says the referendum result was a decisive vote against the way the EU is run.
This current European system doesn't meet the European people's needs. Europe right now is being used to bring in cheap labor, to lower everybody's salary. It is not a very good system.
Might not be working for a lot of people, Stephen, but the European Union is the system that they've got over there. But this dissatisfaction is spreading, right?
Very much so, right across the continent. And this referendum result, coupled with the vote for Brexit, and in fact Donald Trump's victory too, are invigorating anti-establishment opposition parties like the Five Star Movement, but also in France, in the Netherlands, and in Germany, which all have general elections next year. So further electoral upsets are expected, and this is reviving doubts about the survival of the euro and the European Union itself.
Talk to me for a second, would you, Stephen, about European banks, right? Because the euro today was stable. Everything is you know, fine so far. But the European banks are the real issue here, the Italian banks, rather.
That's right, yes. I mean, the biggest market reaction was with the bank shares. Some were down by up to 6%, having fallen by something like 60% so far this year. Italy's banks are the shakiest in the eurozone. They're carrying something like $400 billion of bad loans. Seven of the big Italian banks are in big trouble. And the fear is that the political uncertainty created by this referendum result is going to deter not just foreign but also domestic private investors from putting money into restructuring the banks. Megan Green of Manulife Asset Management says, given the fragile state of banks elsewhere in Europe, this could set off a chain reaction.
It was only a few months ago that Deutsche Bank was on the front page of every newspaper, so you could see contagion spreading beyond Italy to the rest of the EU, and that could certainly affect the cohesion of the currency.
Which says a lot about Europe and the whole project of integration. The euro and the EU have been so battered and bruised by the two great crises, debt and migration, that a referendum on constitutional reform in Italy can send shockwaves through the whole system.
Very quickly, Stephen, what happens now?
It's a very long, I can't do it quickly, it's a very long and complicated and protracted business.
Right.
It could be 14 months before there's a general election and a genuinely new government in power in Italy.
Stephen Beard in London, just back from Rome last week, I think. Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you, Kai.
A pause here for a moment of empathy, specifically empathy and the technology we are surrounded by every day. Even more specifically, empathy and where a lot of that technology comes from. Om Malik, late of Giga Om, if you remember that, is a longtime technology writer, most recently for The New Yorker magazine, where his latest piece is called Silicon Valley Has an Empathy Problem. Om, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
You write in this piece in The New Yorker from a week or so ago that San Francisco, spiritually part of Silicon Valley, as you say, just feels different since the election. Why do you think that is?
I think there was a lot of people believing that this was going to be a walkover for Mrs. Clinton. And I think there is a sense of disappointment and disillusionment in the valley.
Yeah. But you say fundamentally what has happened is that Silicon Valley, and I guess I'm putting words in your mouth a little bit, Silicon Valley has lost touch with the people who use its technology.
There is a lot of people who make great products, but they don't understand that at the end of the day, these products and these services and the data they are collecting is emanating from a human being, and they get impacted by what is happening here in the valley.
Yeah, but if you're a startup entrepreneur running a company, and you say this in the piece, you know, the last thing you have time for when you're trying to staff up and scale and test products and push it out, the last thing you have time for, sad as this is to say, is the end user.
Yeah, but I think we need to change that, right? Like, we can't just say, oh, I don't have time. I think if we don't, then we are going to keep alienating the people we want to serve.
So let's look at an example like Facebook, which you point out here has time and again failed to realize the impact it has, its technology has on the billion plus people who use it. And of course, the most recent example is Mark Zuckerberg saying, oh, no, the fake news from this past election cycle had nothing to do with Facebook. And it took him a week after getting clobbered, really, to backtrack on that one.
I mean, that's a good example of Facebook, you know, thinking about just everything from just like, you know, growth perspective, engagement perspective, not from a human perspective. They don't quite understand how their platform can have a negative impact. Everybody just kind of assumes there is a set way of thinking about the impact of technology. And there is very, you know, very difficult to find alternatives.
What are we supposed to do then, Om? I mean, technology marches ever onward, and as we've seen in this election, we are all living in our bubbles. What do we do?
The first thing we could do is actually listen better. Forget, you know, the filter bubbles. We should just listen better. And the second thing we could do is, can we bring along all the industries which we are impacting into the future with us? And if we cannot, can we retrain some of the people and bring them along? Unless we think about these things, I don't think we can go anywhere.
The last paragraph of this piece, you say, we should take a trip to parts of America, or Silicon Valley, and people who work there should take a trip to parts of America where $5 lattes and freshly pressed juices are not perks, but a reminder of haves and have-nots. Otherwise, come 2020, Silicon Valley will have become an even bigger villain in the popular imagination. So this is a time-sensitive thing here for you.
I do believe so. And I think right now we don't even know what is possible except for, oh, here is a check for $20 million. Now go away. A $20 million charity is not enough. I'm not talking about, you know, charity is in many ways like taking a sympathetic view and that's the end of it. Whereas having an empathy means trying to do something more positive and help people. We are the only growth industry right now, and we have to be very careful how, you know, we interact with the society.
Om Malik writes on technology and society for The New Yorker magazine. He's a partner at True Ventures as well in Silicon Valley. His piece in The New Yorker is called Silicon Valley Has an Empathy Vacuum. Om, thanks very much.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up.
Part of the trick here is to learn how to think short and long term at the same time.
Not so much predicting the future as framing it the right way. But first, let's do the numbers. Another day, another record. The Dow Industrial is up 45 points, 0.2%, 19,216. The NASDAQ up 53 points, 1%, 5308. The S&P 500 up 12 points, about 0.5%. 2204. As we mentioned earlier, news broke this weekend that work on the Dakota Access Pipeline is not going to be going forward, for now anyway. Protesters up there in the cold, pretty happy. The oil companies involved, not so much. Energy Transfer Equity slumped 2.5%. Energy Transfer Partners down 1.7%. Sportswear maker Under Armour announced it's moving into the big leagues today. Signed a 10-year contract with Major League Baseball to make uniforms beginning in 2020. Under Armour shares stepped up to the plate. Man, that would have been a great joke if I'd gotten it. Rising 1.3%. Nike, which will be dressing the NBA next year, up 2.7%. All right, maybe not a great joke. You're listening to Marketplace.
Coming up this season on Codebreaker.
If we want to survive, we need to change our bodies.
I never in my wildest dreams when I was teaching her how to do this thought that she would actually have to do it.
We are back with a second season and a new question. Can it save us? We're asking this question of a different kind of technology every week. Subscribe now on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen, decode, and decide.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There are things about business and economics that are just odd, don't make much sense on the face of them. That is why we do a segment where you ask questions and we answer. It's called I Have Always Wondered.
If you wonder...
By asking 1,000 questions to get one answer, by brain work and blade work.
Listener Karen Johannes of Westminster, Colorado, sent us this email. I'm very short, she wrote, 4'9", and I have a terrible time finding clothes, as do many of my friends and relatives. So she wanted to know how clothing makers figure out what size of clothes to make. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman is on that one from our bureau at Oregon Public Broadcasting.
How many times have you gone into a store, Gap, Nordstrom, Target, and taken a whole bunch of clothes in your size to the fitting room and then left without buying a thing because nothing even close to fit you? Turns out this is pretty common, says Amanda Chernofsky, who studies the fashion industry at Temple University.
Clothing sizes make no sense, and they never have.
Chernofsky, a sociologist, recently went deep into fashion, working as a plus-sized model, and wrote a book about it. She says, to understand how we arrived at size chaos, we have to understand where the industry came from. Until the early 1900s, most people made their own clothes, or if they were rich enough, had a tailor or dressmaker do it for them. By mid-century, most people were buying ready-to-wear clothing produced in modern textile mills, like this one in Passaic, New Jersey, featured in an industrial film of the 1940s.
For over 50 years, Botany products have answered the demand for quality and style within the reach of the average American pocketbook.
It's the era of mass-produced clothing for the growing middle class, sold at department stores and from the Sears catalog. And World War II has a big impact, says Chernofsky.
The government was interested in standardizing sizing to conserve fabric, you know, the booming catalog industry. It was costing them about $10 million a year not to have set sizes.
Because people returned missized, ill-fitting clothing by the trainload. So the USDA, which then had a Bureau of Home Economics, hired statisticians
to collect data on 15,000 women and measure them in 59 different places.
And in 1958, issued the first standardized women's size guidelines. By the 1980s, though, brands had abandoned the standards and developed their own. As a result, different brands of clothing that are marked with the same size can vary by as much as 3 to 4 inches. And Chernofsky says major apparel brands actually like having their own proprietary sizing.
And part of the reason is that it forges brand loyalty. If you find a pair of pants that fits you well, you're going to continue buying from that same brand.
Another reason they want to have their own unique sizes, consumer psychology. Tasha Lewis, who teaches apparel design at Cornell University, says brands adjust their sizes to make female customers feel thinner. It even has a name in the industry.
Vanity sizing is very real. I worked at one company to make their customer that wore 2 feel like she wore 0. They shifted all of the measurements down.
And Lewis says many brands just won't make clothes to fit bigger women in the plus size range. They want to be associated with a skinnier image.
So if you're not that size, maybe a celebrity on the red carpet, they don't have a sample for you to wear.
And what's the future hold? New apparel startups are now using 3D scanners and smartphone apps to take precise body measurements, send the data to a small batch textile factory, and custom produce a garment sized and fitted for you. which can be pricey and is only available from a few stores and websites so far. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
What if you knew what the future was going to bring? Not in a what's going to happen day after tomorrow sense, but in a broader business kind of sense. If you knew which technologies were going to change the way we live and which are just a fun little blip in time. Yes, that is oversimplifying just a bit, but it's the thrust of futurist Amy Webb's new book. It's called The Signals Are Talking, Why Today's Fringe is Tomorrow's Mainstream. Amy, it's good to have you back on the program.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
I need you to tell me what a futurist is and does, because I can't be the only one who doesn't quite get it.
Right. So this is a sort of made-up sounding job title.
Well, a little bit, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, futurists are folks who specialize in lots of different disciplines, and the focus is not to predict what might happen next, but instead to forecast, given what we know to be true today, and doing extensive modeling using evidence and data, what might be the possible scenarios tomorrow, and what do we do about it?
So let me get you to stuff you mentioned in the book, and one of the examples that comes up is Google Glass, right, which was out there and didn't really ever catch on, but now we have Snapchat Spectacles, which is sort of different but kind of the same. You wear it on your face. How do you differentiate trend from trendy?
So if you take a broader look, for me, Google, you know, depending on who you talk to, those crazy-looking glasses that didn't really have lenses, right, that Google made, a lot of people pointed at that and said that was a colossal failure. I see it as part of a much bigger ecosystem. It's one of many things that Google is building that uses our data, and that data powers a bigger system, and that bigger system makes our lives a little bit better every single day, and therefore we don't think about how much of our data is being used and in what ways.
Right, and it makes our lives better. We have to say this because people are going to hear this and go, wait a minute, Kyle, you got to call her on this. It makes lives better at some cost of privacy.
Absolutely.
You know, so there's that.
That's absolutely right. Yeah.
How much is your life complicated by the increasing rate of change in this society, whether it's digital, whether it's, you know, the news cycle, whether it's you name it, things are just happening ever faster. How much of a problem is that for you?
Well, I'll give you a concrete example. So every year my company puts out a pretty huge annual report. These are all the trends you need to sort of pay attention to for the next year. Mm-hmm. We had to rewrite about 40% of it after the election. And it was not because I had predicted that any one person would win. It's just that, you know, we can't write two versions of a giant report. And I think that's a great reminder to everybody that there can only be one thing that happens next, right? So Edward Lorenz, who's the father of chaos theory, said that, right? It is incumbent upon all of us to accept the fact that things are changing, that the rate of change is fast, and there is a light at the end of the tunnel, and that is having some way to deal with all of this information overload, right? If you have some kind of plan, that then you're fine.
I imagine the idea of unintended consequences is your worst nightmare. I mean, just looking at that report you had to rewrite.
You know, you can't do something. I don't know. I see some companies doing these 100-year reports. They're looking 100 years into the future, and what's driving going to look like in 100 years? Who cares? Right? That's a really, you know, it's a clever marketing tactic, but that's a really stupid thing to waste your time on. But also only focusing on the next 12 to 18 months isn't a good idea either. So part of the trick here is to learn how to think short and long term at the same time. And in doing that, you start planning ahead, and those unintended consequences at least become visible at the fringe, at the beginning. And they're there. And maybe you don't have a solution to them, but at least you are cognizant of the fact that, you know, those are possibilities and you don't write them off.
Do you ever look backwards?
Of course I look backwards. That's another really, really fascinating thing to me. You know, everybody has fetishized the future, and yet they forget the past.
Right.
People freak. So we're in a cycle of people freaking out about AI.
Yes, we are.
But this exact same cycle goes all the way back to the invention of the light bulb, and then again with cars, and then again with computers. But none of these technologies happen overnight. That's the whole point of the book. And the clear message, I think, for anybody in business, and that is you have to pay attention to what's happening right now. You have to look back in time to what has already happened, and you also have to be paying attention to what's possible, what might happen in the future.
Amy Webb, her new book is called The Signals Are Talking. Amy, thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
We've got an excerpt of Amy's book for you on our website. It is, of course, marketplace.org. Final note on the way out today, courtesy of Bloomberg Carrier. Yes, that carrier, the heating and air conditioning company so much in the news of late, says it's going to raise commercial and residential prices by as much as 5% come the new year. The company says the decision is not related to the $7 million in incentives that it got last week, courtesy of President-elect Trump and Vice President-elect slash Indiana Governor Mike Pence. All right, we got to go. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bonder, Robert Garova, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.